interview with Commander J.D. Lowe, 12th of May, 1997. Commander Lowe, if we could start this afternoon by you telling us when you first joined the RCN and any relevant training, either fixed wing or on rotary wing aircraft, and take us through until you became CO of HS-50, the helicopter squadron.
Well, I joined my actual joining anniversary, the 60th, was last Saturday, the 10th of May. So I got an early start. I was 17 at the time, a boy seaman. And well, I did various things, like I was a gunner's mate and I was a diver. And then I became an upper yardsman. I was commissioned 41, I think it was. And I went through D-Day in a destroyer, Algonquin. And towards the end of 44, we had a requirement for some aviators to, some fishhead aviators is what I'm trying to tell you. Most of the people that we had in aviation at that time were all ex-Air Force or ex-RNBR people who had transferred. And Ray Creary and Tommy Wall and I came back to Canada and we did elementary flying training. I can't remember where it was. It's in my logbook somewhere. And then we went to Kingston to do advanced flying training. I guess it was called that. 60 years or 50 years is a long time. I joined 825 Squadron in Burscough, UK, which is around Liverpool. That was the spring of 45. We came back to Canada and all that kind of stuff. I no sooner got to Victoria when the carrier came around to the West Coast. And they sent me back to UK to do an air gunnery officer's course. So then I went to the air station. I went to headquarters. While I'm in headquarters in 1951, we had a requirement for helicopter pilots because we had either had or were procuring icebreakers.
Right.
Well, George Marlowe and I, we went to Ellison Field in Pensacola, and we checked out in helicopters. I've forgotten how many hours we got, but we did it on, there goes my memory again. I'll have to look in my book, but on Bell 47th, and I've forgotten the other one. And then I was sent to New Jersey to, God, I just told you the name of the place.
Oh, Lakehurst or?
Lakehurst. And I was sent to USS Edisto, which was an icebreaker, and did a tour up in the Arctic Ocean. Came back to Canada. At that point, we formed number one helicopter flight. I think we had six Battle 6 47s. Yeah, at this point my memory is starting to get rustier than ever. We had a change of name and a whole bunch of stuff. Then they decided that we'd better get a bigger aircraft for the icebreaker, of which we only had one. And
would that have been the Hup?
Then we got the Hup.
All right.
At this point, I was on exchange duty with HS-3 3 in Weeksville, U.S. Naval Air Facility, Weeksville, which is in North Carolina. And there I got checked out on HUPS and HO4S. I guess that was about all. From there I went to VX1 in Florida, in Key West.
Was that the experimental squadron for the U.S.
Yeah,
Navy?
Yeah.
All right.
Same as VX-10 was our experimental. And there I got checked out on the Piasecki Banana. And I can't remember the designation of the dang thing.
Was that the HUK, I think?
No. HUK was a command.
All right.
That was another one that I got checked out on. As a matter of fact, well, I've got a list in my book. The only memorable thing about the banana was that there was no skin on the outside. All it was just frames.
Right.
You sat in the pilot seat, strapped yourself there. The Kojo sat alongside you, and away you went. And what'd they do then?
Following your time as CO of VH-21 squadron, which you took over in 53, did you go back to headquarters?
Oh, yeah, I spent a couple of tours in headquarters.
All right. We'll just stop the tape here for a second. Following your time as CO of VH-21, you go off to the States, to Weeksville, and you wind up coming back to headquarters as staff officer helicopters on the staff of the Director of Naval Aviation. You spent 2 years in that position. That's should be fairly accurate. And you eventually wind up becoming CO of HS-50 with the Sea Kings in 64, is that correct?
Yeah, September 64, I was back as a CO of HS-50.
All right, well, perhaps if we can just go back and start with some of your early career then. In 1950 or 51, you were checked out on rotary wing aircraft down in the States.
Yeah, right.
And you were checked out on the Bell 47s, I think, if I remember correctly. That would have been in Florida, would it?
That was at Pensacola.
At Pensacola.
Ellison Field. And the CO's name was Captain Moore.
You had spent your time as a pilot flying fixed-wing aircraft. What were your impressions about going off to be on a conversion course to be checked out on rotary wing aircraft?
I volunteered because I thought it would be a challenge and B, a hell of a good experience.
And did you find it to be a challenge?
Oh yeah.
Did you?
Initially, because it takes a little getting used to for a fixed wing pilot to stop, 6 or 8, 10 feet above the ground.
Right.
Once you get over that, which only takes a week or 10 days, until you're comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters are, I think, the easiest damn things to fly, but they're also the most versatile, which means they're the most fun.
Right. Do you? I'd heard that that some of the pilots that were sent off on training down to the States to be checked out on rotary wing aircraft, they were normally gone for about 6 weeks. Would that does that seem about right? Or do you
about 6 weeks, maybe a little less. I honestly can't remember, but it seems to me, we were 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks maybe at Pensacola, and shuffled up to New Jersey.
Right, up to Lakehurst.
Lakehurst, right. I don't know why I can't remember Lakehurst. I wish I could think of the other damn helicopter, the small trainer that we got.
I'll just stop the tape here and check something. So you were down in the States and you're being checked out on the Bell helicopter. What were your impressions of that particular aircraft at the time?
I thought it was a pretty pleasant little job to fly. It didn't have much power in it. It was limited in terms of engine power and all the rest of it. And as they improved the thing, it just made it that much more adaptable in terms of carrying passengers, carrying a load.
Right. Now, if I remember correctly, the Bell 47s were the ones that the Americans used quite a bit during the Korean War for medical rescue.
Yes.
And for the Canadian Navy, not only did that aircraft be used by the utility squadron, but didn't the Canadian Navy think about embarking the Bell 47 on the Canadian icebreaker for an observation role?
I can't recall. I think probably they did, but at that point I've forgotten where I was. Headquarters or down the States or
right.
Somewhere remote from the immediate scene anyway.
The other aircraft... You were also checked out on or had an opportunity to fly the Hiller aircraft. Was that similar to the Bell 47 in terms of lifting capability and the type of role that it would perform?
Yeah, it was the same class, but it wasn't... I didn't think it was up to the Bell 47.
All right.
One of the tricky things about that was the stick, when you're on the ground,
mm-hmm.
it had to be way over to the right, and as soon as you took off, it had to be centered.
Okay.
So when you were flying and getting on the ground or getting off, it was a matter of getting used to
the movement.
And the first ones in the Hiller, they had the stick overhead.
Oh, really?
Which was, that was way back.
I seem to remember reading something about that. That must have been a very strange place to have the stick.
For training, where we were, I think that lasted about maybe a week. Praying too many of them.
So, following your training in the Bell, you were attached to USS Edisto. Is that the correct?
Edisto, yeah.
Edisto,
yeah.
Which was an American aircraft carrier.
No,
icebreaker. All right. This would have been for familiarization in order to come back to the RCN because we were just about ready to commission our own icebreaker.
Yeah, that was part of the thing. Think, but general sort of. Well, I was attached to HU-3
mm-hmm.
in Lakehurst, and the Canadian authorities lost all control of me until I was sent back. So, HU-3 sent me where they wanted.
Right.
They happened to want to send me to an icebreaker, so I went.
What were your recollections of flying aboard the American icebreaker up north?
No big deal, really.
Really?
No.
What sort of heat was available inside the cabin of a Bell 47, or was there any for northern flying operations?
No, there wasn't any, but it was a big bubble.
Mm-hmm.
The sun was always shining.
Right.
So that generated a certain amount of heat, and we always wore what they call northern trousers, which were heavy, feltish kind of trousers and jackets and a cap,
right.
Gloves. So there was no discomfort. I don't recall ever being cold or uncomfortable.
What were the difficulties flying up north as opposed to flying anywhere else that you had been, either fixed-wing or rotary-wing aircraft?
All we had was a magnetic compass. You can imagine what the compass was doing. It was really totally unreliable. So the way one of your major things was looking for ice leads to, so the icebreaker could take the convoy of ships or whatever they were convoying through the easiest part. So when you're out scouting around, if you pass a prominent iceberg, you always turned around and looked at it from the backside.
Right.
Because when you turned around, you were going back. That's the face of the iceberg you'd be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to try and remember two or three of these rascals, which meant you were on the right way to, you know, getting back to the ship.
Oh, boy.
That was probably the only odd sort of thing that went on. But we never really got, we couldn't get that far away from the ship because we were always down fairly low.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio didn't have that much range, so if you wanted to talk to the ship.
Right.
You either had to get up fairly high,
mm-hmm.
or you had to be fairly close to the ship. So.
Do you have a recollection roughly of the type of distances that you're talking about? 20, 30 miles maybe, or would you be closer than that?
I think, around 30, maybe a bit more.
Do you ever remember experiencing... So your preference would have been to be in visual range of the ship when you were out scouting and providing observation?
Yes, please.
Did you ever have any mechanical problems when you were flying?
No.
With engine problem or anything like that?
No.
That you had to set down?
Only reason we sat down, of course we were on floats.
All right.
And the only reason we sat down was just to practice auto rotation.
Oh, I see.
Onto the ice floes.
Onto the ice floes.
And we always had a 0.25 gun in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the polar bears and the seals and what have you were...
Right.
A few around.
So were you... When you were off flying off the American icebreaker, were you normally flying solo or did you have somebody in the seat beside you?
Usually you had somebody else.
All right.
Very seldom another pilot. It was usually somebody who wanted to go down. What do we call the weather guessers now?
Oh, meteorologists?
Meteorologists, yeah. No, they're calling environmentalists or meteorologists. I can't remember. And it doesn't matter.
All right.
We often had one of those rascals. There were a number of scientists aboard Disco who were doing all kinds of crazy things like, water salinity and charts and matter in the water.
Right.
Tidal flows, which weren't very bloody exciting because of the damn ice that always screwed up there, so they gave that up, I'm sure. What else are these guys doing? Oh, they had somebody was doing a temperature. I've forgotten what he was trying to prove. Whether he was looking at critical for ice fog or
uh-huh.
whatever it was. They thought they knew, but so often we got caught out that I think they're going to redo the numbers.
Right.
But we often had one of those jokers. And if nobody else was going, we'd take one of the mechanics, give them a break.
Mm-hmm.
That way, you always made sure that they didn't overlook anything, because I never knew when they were going to be flying.
Mm-hmm. So all of the flying aboard the American Icebreaker would have been daytime flying only.
Oh, yes.
And
we didn't have any night.
No instrumentation.
No, we didn't have any.
Oh, right. You're up there in the summer. That's true, too. I forgot about that. What was the normal range for the Bell 47? Do you have any recollection of that at all?
Oh, Lord.
Either in terms of miles or hours?
I think we had about an hour and a half, which meant you could get what? There and back. About 60 miles, I think, there and back.
With your reserve in case ran into any problems?
We had an auxiliary tank when we were doing long distance, I'm sure.
All right.
But that buggered me.
You were mentioning when the tape was off that you had to set down once, at least once, because of ice fog. Was that a normal sort of occurrence, even during the summer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but because it was summer didn't mean that the water was warm.
Mm-hmm.
It was still full of ice.
So that would, the visibility would close in completely.
But you got a little warning on the thing. You know, it wasn't like
instant.
That. It was, you know what it's like. I keep thinking you're a sailor.
No, I don't have that much experience, no. So if you encountered ice fog and you were too far away from the ship, you'd just set down on the ice floe and wait out the conditions?
Yeah.
Would that be the normal procedure?
Yeah.
And that would vary?
That was very seldom.
All right.
Very seldom, really. As I recall, the ice fog tended to form over open water more than it formed over ice. So that you're flying over ice, there was no problem really, and there wasn't that much open. Well, there was a fair amount of open water, but not enough to worry you too much.
Right. Can we just talk about landing operations aboard the Icebreaker for a moment?
Sure.
I assume that you were flying in fairly good weather for the most part.
Hmm.
And the ship would have been steaming when you're coming in for your approach and landing. What sort of arrangements were made for sort of securing the aircraft to the flight deck once you landed? You talked about the helicopter having floats, but you don't want it moving around the flight deck too much. Were there aircraft handlers aboard the Icebreaker?
We had a crew of about 9 or 10, I guess, a chief and bunch of sailors, and when we sat down, we just hold the collective down as hard as you could, which meant the negative pitch on the blade, which tended to hold it down.
All right.
And you always knew when you're going to have trouble, because if it got a little gusty, it might, you know, wobble the thing.
Right.
But they just threw the tie-downs on them. There were bolts on the deck, eye bolts to
all right.
Snap them into.
So the tie-down or lash-down points would have been two or four for the aircraft?
Normally four.
Four? Each corner?
One at each end of each float.
All right, okay. Do you remember whether or not you were having to file reports back to headquarters on flying operations off the American Icebreaker? Because the Canadian Navy had never done this yet. We're getting ready.
I don't remember ever doing it, no.
So you would have been just filling in your logbook, but no reports even back to the squadron or anything?
No, the senior officer on the detachment was a USN lieutenant. God, I think he had about 15 years seniority. The senior boy, he had to do all the reporting.
All right. So following your time with the American icebreaker. You returned to Canada and became CEO of number one helicopter flight, is that correct?
Right.
And at that time, I think we only had the Bell 47s in the Canadian Navy. So what sort of duties was the helicopter flight performing in the Canadian Navy at that time?
The normal sort of thing from Shearwater to the dockyard.
All right.
All the VIPs always wanted to. They didn't want to go by boat. They didn't want to drive all the way around to get to the McDonald Bridge.
Right.
Well, I guess it was in McDonald Bridge. I can't remember if it was there then. So they wanted to flip over in a helicopter. We used to do, ships wanted to check their radar ranging, gun ranging things, and we'd go out a certain way, and they'd check the ranges and whatever. We used to do a fair amount of search and rescue.
All right.
There were always hunters getting lost in the bloody woods, or few occasions there were fishermen who had lost or strayed or sunk. What else did we do?
In the case of search and rescue, would they strap on or bolt on a stretcher on the outside of the Bell 47? Was that how the situation?
No. You never knew what you were going to get. Usually, if you could find the guy, you had to get a ground crew in, because if you were lucky enough to find a place to set the helicopter down, the guy wouldn't have been lost in the first place. So we'd have spotted him.
Right. What are your impressions about the relationship between the Air Force and the Navy as it relates to the helicopters in the early days there out at Shearwater? I mean, there was some sort of shared responsibility between the two services as it related to aircraft at that time.
No, at Shearwater, there was an RCAF communication flight, and I think they had a DC-3, Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all they had.
All right.
And they certainly didn't have any helicopters. And I think the only choppers the Air Force had were at Rivers. And I think they only had one or maybe two up there. So there was never any, there was nothing to coordinate, there was nothing to confront or so.
Right.
It just never, there was just no, there was nothing there to either like or dislike or anything else. It was the Navy running its helicopters, and that was it.
And the Air Force
didn't have it.
Taking care of their own responsibilities.
Yeah.
When you became CO of VH-21, was the Navy still flying the Bell 47? Was that the only helicopter in its inventory at that time?
Oh, boy.
So it was still the Bell 47 with the VH-21 in 53. So following your 2 years with the squadron as CO, you were then sent down to the States for more rotary wing flying, is that correct?
Yeah, I went to HF-3. Helicopter Squadron 3 in Weeksville.
All right.
But we must have had an H-04S in Shearwater before that time, because I went down to
that would have been the 2, I assume, or was that the 3?
Must have been the 2.
Right.
Because when I went down to HS3 in Weeksville, I was immediately made the operations officer.
Oh, I see. All right.
So obviously, I had been flying the horse.
So where were you have been checked out on the Sikorsky helicopter then?
It's coming back to me slowly. While we were in Shearwater, in VH-21, we three of us were sent down to Sikorsky plant in
Connecticut.
Right, I'm trying to think of that. Bridgeport. And we got checked out by the company pilot. And we flew two back, and maybe you did three trips, I can't remember.
Right.
But we had the HO4S in VH-21. Then I think I was sent off to HS, or maybe I went to headquarters in between.
I'll just stop the tape here and turn it over.